Welcome to Configure It Done, the podcast where SAP leaders share real insights, proven strategies, and stories from front lines of major SAP transformations. Get inspired, get informed, let's get it done.
Welcome back to the Configure It Done podcast. We've just been running an S4 do's and don'ts series. We've interviewed some fantastic guests that have got the battle scars and the war wounds of some large transformations. And Seb, you've invited another fantastic guest that again is off the back of a large S4 transformation. So today we're going to learn from the insights from that program. But Seb, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Yeah, sure. So probably a lot of people that won't be listening to this will probably know Paul already, but 20 years in the oil and gas industry, 5 years managing S4 programs, probably known around Perth, and has just come off a very interesting program, which we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Seb, and the invitation. And it's great to talk to you today as well, Jay.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's dive straight in. Can you give us a bit of an overview, Paul, of the program, just really, really high level? And we've got some specific questions to ask after that. But just for context, can you explain to our listeners what your program was?
Sure. So this program of work was about transitioning a mining company from ECC, which was on-premise, to S4 in SAP's private cloud. Obviously, all the integration, all the data as well. And then also introduce some Fiori applications, SAP Analytics Cloud, as well as Analytics for Office. So it was a brownfield lift and shift with a bit of an introduction of some of the improvements that come with S4, which was an appetizer then for a future transformation roadmap. So that was the core scope of the project. And additional to that, we developed some strategies around UI, UX, reporting analytics, integration and security, and also a 3 to 5 year roadmap of improvements that then the organization could chip away at over the following years.
Yeah, okay. So what was the kind of overall size of the program then, Paul, for our listeners?
So it was, the S4 program was about a year or a little under a year from start to finish. We had about sort of 20 people on the project seconded in, and they might have been on for a little bit of time or a longer period of time. Most of the people were full time, and then with a partner they flex between sort of 20-30 people most of the time up to sort of 40-50 people depending on what technology was being touched.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks for giving us a little bit more of an overview, Paul. And I think especially when we originally started talking about getting you on the podcast, you talked a little bit around, you know, what was happening during the project. And I think you mentioned once the business case was approved and the team decided to move from ECC to S4, what would be really interesting, and I think a lot of our listeners always kind of ask this as well, is what did those early days look like? So what was the main driver behind making that shift?
Yeah, so I started as the business case was approved. Mm-hmm. So when I started, my initial activities were getting to know the organization, understanding the key stakeholders, and then talking with those people who had set up the project, understanding some of the reasons and rationale behind why we're doing things the way we did, and then having that initial kickoff meeting. So we had a technical kickoff meeting with the technical team so we could start talking to SAP about setting up the RISE or the private cloud environment, and then a business kickoff meeting once we had a bit more of an understanding and we had some of the partners' resources available, and that really set then the organization up to understand what they needed to do, how we were going to do it, and at what times we would need them. From a delivery point of view, it was really ramping up. So that was hiring a project manager, change manager, test managers, project support, recruiting the business SMEs. So we seconded three people from the key functions into the project. So we wanted to make sure we had people who were trusted, who implicitly knew the business processes, so that when they looked at something, they knew that it has changed and they had a pretty good understanding of the impact of that change and who to talk to about that. Additionally, we wanted to onboard the partner as quickly as possible, so that, you know, the logistics around setting up accounts, access, getting them into the sandbox system, and then finding people desks. We, you know, when I started, I just had a temporary desk outside of my boss's office, so we needed a bit more space to grow into, so that was key. And then really from a transformation point of view, we needed additional resources separate from the core project to be able to look at some of the work that had already been done and be able to then prioritize those projects.
It sounds like there's obviously a lot of moving parts there, and obviously it was quite a big team at the time as well. But when we met up before, Paul, you had you mentioned a principle of the program, and that's you can only go as fast as your slowest component. But in a program that size, how did you live by that day to day?
Yeah, and that's probably something I did learn on a project before this one. It did have a few more go lives, and that was key, that all those interdependencies were linked together. So you really needed to make sure that you went live. And so coming into this project, it was looking at what was the end goal. So working backwards from the end goal, making sure that we knew what successful go live required or was, and then what it required. That helped us then work backwards of when you do move into your QA and your dress rehearsals, what are the elements, what are the work streams that need to be pulled together. So from that, we could develop a high-level plan on a page which showed the different work streams, showed how they all interrelated to one another and what it needed to be achieved. We did have a lead for each of those work streams, and then they had a more detailed understanding of, for each of the work streams, what they needed to do to achieve the state at whatever particular time, whether we're going into SIT or UAT. We needed to have got the system ready, tested it to some level, had all the, say, all the testers ready and all the test scripts. So that was important to understand at a high level how all those streams came together. Mm-hmm. Internally, we would start the week with a meeting where each of the stream leads would talk about where they're at, what their blockers were, and how they needed support. And then as a whole project team with a partner and even some of the SMEs in the business, we had a fortnightly project review meeting where each of the streams presented what they'd achieved in the last fortnight, where they were at, and what would be achieved in the next fortnight. And could call that a bit of a three in a box, where we had the partner, the business representative or process lead, as well as the BAU SME from the SAP team. Those three people needed to be aligned to be able to present a unified view of where their stream was at right now and what some of the issues or difficulties were. And then they were presenting to their colleagues and other team members. That helped everyone understand some of the interdependencies. You know, if finance were going to be late on something, what would that mean to a different stream or vice versa? So it really helped people align at least every fortnight. What you're also trying to do, it was a 12-month project with a bit of a ramp up at the beginning. You're trying to bring people together and help them feel comfortable reaching out and picking up a phone when there is an issue, rather than waiting for a formal meeting or sending an email or something like that. So you're trying to help people work together, and that type of format, I think, really helped people understand who was who and what their responsibilities were. And then, you know, of course, at the end of the week, we'd close out with a formal project status meeting with the partner, and that would help us align on, you know, did we achieve what we needed to, and are we heading in the right direction? And at a high level, we also set out quite clear quality gates, so criteria for entry and exit into phases or system migrations. And that helped us align to what was important for starting, say, the dev migration, and then mm-hmm. what was important to exiting the dev migration. What was the success factors? How could you say you achieved it or not?
Yeah, I was just curious there, Paul. You mentioned about bringing the team or bringing people together. We've just done our SAP talent survey where we survey 4,500 candidates and clients in the market. And one of the questions we asked is around office time. And it's come out in that survey that a typical SAP resource would have 2 to 3 days in the office. But I was just curious, you said about bringing people together. What was the expectation for the resources on the program in terms of office time?
Yeah, and we had a blend of, we're in Perth, so just say 2/3 of the partner team were in Perth.
Yeah.
Pretty much all of the, yeah, all of the project team on the customer side were in Perth as well. So we at least wanted weekly touch points, so one day a week, if not two, because I do think there's a lot of value of face-to-face time.
Yeah.
It builds relationships. You know, if people are around, there's a lot more connectivity and collaboration. You know, you can see the few people in the room, so you can bring them together, you can address that problem, and you can move forward. So we did fluctuate. So early on, it was really building that team. One day a week, 2 days a week was probably the norm.
Yep.
Once we got into SIT and UAT, it was as much as possible. So SIT and UAT, we did get as many business people in the room as well. And we did have, you know, lots of lunch and food put on, lollies, things like that to encourage people into the office. But when you have a problem, if you can pull together all your functional and technical people and you can see it, I think you're more able to then get it resolved quickly.
Yeah.
So it did fluctuate, but my feel is as much as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it does fascinate me, the different organizations' approach to office time. You'd be surprised the amount of organizations that have mandated 5 days in the office, you know, and it only heightens when there's a program. But I think, yeah, what you mentioned there, that's a pretty good approach where people still get the flexibility, but at crucial points, they are in the office.
Yeah. And you've got to understand some people do need to travel a long way because, you know, we're a project site. They might be, some people also might have been split from a partner perspective, 50% on our project and 50% on another. So you try and work with them, but as much as possible, FaceTime really helped out. And I think from a business point of view, when they were talking to some of the key business SMEs, being able to see them and be in a meeting room and draw things on a whiteboard, it helps build a bit of trust that you're a person rather than just a, you know, an avatar on the computer screen. And certainly, you know, video cameras is a minimum they need to be on. No.
Yeah, I think we see that a lot with customers now as well, because we have a lot of customers that go, okay, well, we need people, you know, either on site 3 days or 4 days. And obviously you have a lot of, you know, consultants that complain going, you know, well, I was doing this beforehand. But I think I agree. I think you need to have that element of being able to have everyone in a round table discussion, everyone kind of talking there. And it's not, you know, booking in a Teams meeting with everyone. Everyone's kind of in a room and they can collaborate and actually have a more cohesive discussion. So I think that's it's definitely important for sure. Yeah. Now, I remember when we were talking last time, Paul, you mentioned around that the idea before anything was to get S4HANA done first, and then the transformation would come afterwards. why would you say was separating that transition from the transformation so important? Because obviously, you know, once you went live, you probably would have seen benefits. What were those benefits that kind of came with that?
Yeah. So I think the key reason for splitting out the transformation from just the initial brownfield transition was about focus. So the organization, you know, would benefit from getting to S/4HANA. And from an SAP point of view, it's being pushed for future support. Also, the organization was on aging infrastructure, so it really needed to do something. So the key driver was to address the technology, move it to the cloud, and then move forward. The benefit of splitting it was that we could control scope quite well. The business only had to give up limited resources to test and validate the migrated system in S4 worked like ECC did before. There was a few changes. There were a few changes, but not wholesale. If we were going to make wholesale changes and transformation, then that would require them to be a lot more engaged and we would consume more of their resources. And like I spoke about earlier, you can only go as fast as your slowest stream. Mm-hmm. Then you start to see some streams going a lot slower than others. And so you are putting at risk your transition to S4, which is your critical, which was the company's critical reason for initiating the project. So what the organization had done, they'd split it out into three phases. One was to simplify. So they did actually move out the HR function as well as payroll into SuccessFactors just prior to the S4 transition.
Okay.
And that project did encounter a few hurdles and troubles, and it did take longer than expected. If that had been with the S4 project, then the S4 project would have then been pushed out another 6 or 12 months. So you can see that that would have then required us to retain the same S4 project team for an additional 6 to 12 months, and that's at a much higher cost. So that was the risk-benefit that the organisation chose. Then once on S4, it was now the each of the functions could do as they wished. So if they decided that, you know, they had a burning need to move forward with a particular project, they could do it and they could set up a business case and they could go and address that one problem. If the function felt that they were pretty good and they had other pressing issues outside of SAP, then they could defer that for another 6 months or 12 months. So by this approach, it enabled the functions to determine as and when and at what pace they move forward on their transformation journey. Whereas if you lump it all together, you're forcing each of the functions to come together and move at a particular pace.
But that got a lot of buy-in.
Yeah. And look, from a scope control point of view, you could find a partner who can do the S4, but maybe you needed a different partner to do the transformation. So it creates a more complex transformation program if you do that. The S4HANA project was approved in the context of obsolescence, so it needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And then assuming that the value would be delivered or derived from future projects that the functions would then set up and drive through.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Paul, congratulations on the go live, and I know it was on time and on budget. Look, my question is, what are the biggest factors that contributed to that success?
I think a huge one is planning. So there was a lot of work done in the lead up to signing that contract with the SI. So once you've signed with the SI, you're kind of locked and loaded, and you just really need to get it done. So understand why you're doing it, understand how you're going to do it. Talk to partners. You don't have to just talk to one. Get a cross-section of opinions about, and then understanding what works for you as an organization. understand what resourcing you'll need to be successful, and then setting up that budget to execute it well. Obviously, once you do get going, having more planning at a lower level detail about each of the phases, each of the systems, what the impact is on the organisation is important. Because me coming in once the business case was approved, and also from a partner point of view, they were cold to it as well. So you need to get a pretty good understanding of the rationale about some of the decisions. So coming together again as a project team to be able to understand and put together the detail was important. And then executive support, I feel, was really important. They were able to, they were very engaged. They helped us when we did encounter problems, access resources that who were unavailable, balance priorities. And being as transparent as possible with them is important because I feel it does build trust. You say, these are the risks, these are the decisions they'll need to make, these are some of the issues we think we're going to face. If that all plays out, they're already prepared for it. You never want to go in to a steering committee or talk to an executive with a huge surprise. Yeah. You want to sort of prepare them ahead of time, and doing that really builds trust. I do also feel getting the most experienced people possible, and also full-time rather than part-time resources is critical. You know, if they're part-time resources and they're BAU, they're often will prioritise a BAU issue over a project deliverable. And then if you have someone who's done that work before rather than someone who hasn't, the person who hasn't is going to be somewhat learning as they go. They might be the smartest person in the world, but then they're going to work it out as they go. Someone who's done it before can be looking further ahead and give advice about some of the pitfalls and some of the things that you need to consider. And then talked about it before, controlling scope. So it, for me, it was a fixed price, fixed scope, which is great. Otherwise, every idea that comes along, you have to have a discussion about it. It, you know, one extra day is not a big deal in a year project, but if you get 100 of them, 200 of them, it starts to slow you down and it puts at risk go live.
Yeah.
So for me, I could always say, yes, that sounds like a great idea. Put it, write it up, and we'll get it in front of the executives at the next steering committee and make sure your GM is supportive of it. That usually put a downer on every potential change, and people really thought, well, do I want to be standing up in front of my GM and having them stand up in front of the executives to get this change through? I think we can do it a different way. So controlling that scope is important.
Yeah.
And what the organisation did was a trial migration. I think there was a lot of fear going into the project initially, especially from, say, the finance group, where there is more change moving to S/4HANA. And, well, what is this going to mean for my organisation? Am I going to have to retrain everyone? Is it going to be massive changes? So doing that sandbox or trial migration and giving the organisation access to it enabled them to get comfort that there wasn't a huge amount of change. It also enabled them to find some problems that then we were able to give to the partner, and they were able to start working on it ahead of the development system.
Yeah.
And then testing is important. You know, we did over 10 times the next largest round of testing, and that sort of gave us a lot of confidence going into cutover that we've done the best that we possibly could.
I was speaking to another CIO the other day, just on your point on change requests coming through there, and his response was, yep, great idea, phase two. Yep, great idea, phase two. And it's literally this scope's locked in. It's going live on this date. We'll look at these later on. So, yeah, very similar approach.
Yeah. And I think always once people get the system, they think they might need these things. But once they get the system, they might feel that they're missing something. But a month or 2 months later, they've forgotten about it, or they've adapted around it, or they understand the system works slightly differently or whatever. So certainly, you know, pushing it out is a good thing.
I think it's a good way of doing it, because I think especially by putting the autonomy on the individual, especially when you're talking about, you know, the steering committee and working groups, and getting them to actually, are you going to commit to actually going up to the GM and, you know, talking about this change? I think that's an important one, because you get to weed out a lot of things that can maybe be done differently and stop people getting thinking in a more creative manner as well. So I think that's a good approach for sure. Yeah. I think you mentioned there, especially around, you know, the executive board and obviously, you know, who was sponsoring the project and who was kind of championing that change. No easy task for yourself, Paul. You're obviously reporting into the CFO, have all these other teams that you have to bring together across finance, marketing, sales, distribution, and then obviously integration as well. It's a big coordination effort, right? So how did you keep everyone aligned and that integration piece running smoothly as well, all at the same time?
Yeah. So I think a big help for me was having a supportive team. So the project team were very capable and supportive. So that was a big plus. And then the organization as a whole, they were very supportive. They were willing to give their time. So that was really important. The executives as well as the GMs were part of the steering committee, because it had sort of flowed over from the SuccessFactors implementation, with the executives more the decision makers and the GMs more supporting them. So that would happen monthly. Additionally, like when I started, I met with them all, tried to build relationships, gain their trust, explain what was going to happen. They gave their perspectives, their concerns, and what they needed. So that helped understand what they're after. Finance GM was also the system owner. So I've met regularly, or more regularly, with that person fortnightly, and that enabled that person to speak more freely about some of the details, some of the past pain. And then once we were running, I set up a stakeholder meeting with the GMs and the seconded people under the project who were their business process representatives. And it was the same content as the Steerco. So we do it, say, the week before Steerco, same content, but we had the business SMEs in there and it was less formal. That allowed everyone to talk more freely and in greater details prior to the steering committee meeting. And my goal, like I said before, was always at Steerco, no surprises. So I didn't want to be dropping something on the GMs at steering committee and then not necessarily know the background or not necessarily be in alignment with that. So going into the steering committee meeting, the GMs were aligned with it. They understood the rationale or the background around it. And so if at the steering committee meeting, executives asked a question, the GM was able to then provide supporting information, which provided the executives a level of comfort that their teams were already saying the same things and aligned with it. And with the project team, I do think that we had someone looking after the business readiness, and they worked with all the business process leads to understand some of the impacts of some of the changes. And then we communicated clearly to those teams and involved some of the key business people in testing. So include them into SIT or UAT where it'll add value or avoid some issues. And that helped us also in post-go-live support. And then internal comms teams, they were very helpful in crafting the message and using the different forums to be able to communicate that message. So overall, you know, from the executives all the way down to the people on the tools, we are able to try and keep the message consistent and keep people informed.
All comes down to communication, doesn't it? But look, Paul, I want to thank you for coming on today. Before we do wrap up, obviously you've gone live with an S4 transformation. That was over a year, you said, or just a year?
Under a year, yeah.
On time and on budget. If you had to look back now and reflect, and if you had to deliver a message to someone or an organization that is embarking on S4, what reflections would you provide that customer?
Yeah, I think my key recommendations would be around planning. So plan. Seek out advice from those who've done it before, whether it's a customer, whether it's a partner, whether it's SAP directly. So get as much information as possible and understand what your organization can and can't do, what their preference is and what will work for the organization. You know, challenge assumptions that have been made and understand the risks and issues that you're going to be facing. And then getting that executive support, that buy-in, because without their support, you're just going to be continually running into headwinds. So if you're looking ahead to making an investment decision, then it might be, you know, millions of dollars. Well, what confidence, what process do they want to have seen gone through to feel comfortable signing off millions of dollars and a year of their life and potential impact to their core technology system? And then when you do get going, having the experience of others. So your partner is important, but they're not going to be the magic bullet. If you don't have a strong team, it's going to be done to you, not done with you. So you want to have people on your side of the fence who can represent you, who can keep the partner honest, and to understand some of the nuances of some of the decisions that are going to be made. So making sure you've got a strong team on your side. And then, you know, controlling the scope. You want to go in with a fixed price and a fixed contract with your partner, because then they're going to be motivated to do what was agreed rather than additional scope. And you can go into that with optional extras. So, you know, maybe there are three or four things that you think you might want to do. You know, get them priced in, get them in the contract, but have a decision point somewhere along the line where you say yes or no, we're going to add it in or not. But don't let the scope run wild.
Brilliant.
That would be the key things for me.
Brilliant. Well, Paul, like I said, I want to say, thank you and congratulations again for going live. And we set up this podcast to create a forum for leaders in the SAP community to learn from other leaders like yourself, and to come on today and explain and give your insights on a successful S4 program is really, really helpful. So thank you for coming on, Paul, and sharing that. And I hope the listeners gain a lot from that and encourage people to get on their S4 journey.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jay and Seb. Appreciate the invitation.
No, thanks for your insights, Paul. It was very informative. Appreciate it.